to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome back to the programme. Today's show from the archives is the first of a two-parter we did back in March 2012 on the subject of miracles, both in the Bible and in the present day. Craig Eskina is a New Testament scholar at Asbury Theological Seminary in Kentucky. His book, Miracles, The Credibility of the New Testament Accounts, is a two-volume work assessing the case for the miracles of Jesus and the many reported cases of miracles around the world. And you may remember, of course, that we had him back very recently with Michael Shermer to discuss evidence specifically for miracle healings. I'm putting the link to that in the show notes. But our other guest on this occasion was Jeff Lillis, an atheist listener from Ireland, and he was contesting the reliability of miracle accounts. They discussed the nature of miracles, Hume's philosophical argument against them, whether the gospel accounts of miracles were invented or embellished, and why does God supposedly hate amputees? Well, before we begin, a reminder to book your place on Unbelievable, the conference 2022, God Unmuted, which is happening in just under 3 weeks' time, Saturday the 14th of May, all about helping Christians to find their voice again, and the church too, in an age where there's often pressure to stay silent. It's being held at the British Library, and you can attend online or in person. Great lineup of speakers. I've mentioned them before: Alistair McGrath, Lisa Fields, Glenn Scrivener, Joseph D'Souza, Calvin Robinson, Sharon Dirks, Jeff Vines, Sky Gitani, Phil Vischer, John Wyatt, and loads of great panel Q&A where we'll really dig into some of the big questions that are facing us in our day and age. Questions like, how do we respond to some of the issues in culture, cancel culture, race, identity, politics, that kind of thing? How do we transform the culture and not be consumed by it? What about practical ways to share our faith in today's often confused and divided society? So there'll be loads of really practical stuff here, lots of opportunity to get involved in Q&A as well. Hope you can be with us. Unbelievable.live is the place to go to book your ticket. You can also be part of our big conversation event at the conference. It's going to be a wonderful discussion between Ian McGilchrist, the eminent brain scientist, and Sharon Dirks, Christian neuroscientist, on whether there's a master behind our minds. Again, unbelievable.live, and the link is available from today's show. For now, hope you enjoy today's Classic Replay. Well, thank you, gentlemen, both, for joining me on the show today. It's great to have you with me, and perhaps we'll start with you, Craig, joining us by phone from where you live in Asbury in Kentucky. Craig, just tell us a little bit of background of yourself, for those who aren't aware of your background. I believe you came to faith as a teenager.
Yes. Yeah, I was not raised in a Christian home or in the home of any particular faith. And I had called myself an atheist probably since at least the age of 9. I remember having some debates with people back then. Somebody said that there must have been a first cause, and I just postulated infinite regression. But when I was about 13, I started reading Plato and started, like, his arguments for the preexistence of a soul and so on didn't seem to be very good arguments. But the questions that he asked about meaning in life and so on got me thinking beyond where I'd been thinking. And when I was about 15, I heard the message of Christianity for the first time. I knew about Christians, but I said, well, you know, 80% of the people in my country claim to be Christian, and I couldn't tell by the way most of them lived that it made a difference in their lives. And I figured they didn't believe in it. Why should I care to believe in it? But I came to believe that that Jesus is who he said he is, and that that's what Christianity rises or falls on.
And you've gone on to have a career as a New Testament scholar. You've done a lot of work, as I mentioned, in terms of looking at the Gospels, looking at their historical credibility. Your Bible background commentary to the New Testament has obviously been very popular. Tell us then, Craig, what got you into the subject of miracles? Because this is an area which is frankly not that often touched upon in academic circles. I think it's often seen as something of a, you know, slightly eccentric area almost to concentrate studies on. So what started your interest in doing a kind of an academic study of miracles?
Yeah, actually, you put it very, very gently. It's the kind of thing that could get one in a lot of trouble, I suppose, in many academic circles. But I became convinced that it was needed. I originally was just writing a footnote for my Acts commentary, which is supposed to start coming out soon. Just as I was dealing with historical reliability, the questions of history, you also have to raise the questions about what happened when you have these miracle claims in the Bible. I mean, 31% of the Gospel of Mark, of the verses in the Gospel of Mark involve miracles, and I'd say maybe one-fifth of the book of Acts does. Mm. So it was something that I thought, okay, well, this merits at least a footnote. And it was in response to the people who say, well, this must all be legendary. Eyewitnesses would never claim these things. So in the footnote, I was simply going to cite a catalog of sources that listed a lot of, you know, eyewitnesses claiming these things, which isn't to say that all of the claims necessarily are actually divine intervention, but just to say you don't have to attribute all these to legend. But I didn't find initially the books I was looking for, so I kept finding different accounts of different experiences, and the footnote got longer and longer, and eventually it became a chapter. And as you see, it's, you know, with 1,200 pages, it grew quite a lot.
And it's an overgrown footnote.
Probably the longest excursion digression I will ever make from my major discipline in historiography. But I felt it needed to be done. I'm sure others can develop it and do it better. But I was giving it the best I could.
I mean, as well as looking at the case for the miracle claims in the New Testament, you cover a wide range of miracle claims in modern day and, you know, over the last century or two. And and I suppose this is the thing, is that many people do think, well, miracles, healing, they think of televangelists, of maybe slightly eccentric oddballs, or it's not the kind of thing which is often people think of as open to rigorous academic study. So how has it been received in the academy in that sense? Did people think this was a strange project to be embarking upon, or was there a feeling that there was a gap here that needed to be plugged?
It may be too early to know what the general response will be. My guess is that there'll be some very negative responses, but so far the responses have been very positive. But I suspect it depends. A lot of it depends, I think, on people's presuppositions and what they want to find. Some people have actually read into the book as arguing for more than I actually argued for. I mean, part of the book I am just exploring. Here are eyewitness claims. I'm not saying what to make of them in that part of the book. So, part of the book is just saying we know from history. When we look at historical documents, we can't use the traditional analogy argument that has often been used to say miracles didn't happen or these kinds of experiences didn't happen, because we know that eyewitnesses never claim that. We can't use that argument. Now, as far as how we explain them, that's going to come down a lot more to presuppositions, and I think that in some cases we can make a better argument for one case or another. But I think it would be very difficult to say that eyewitnesses don't claim most of the kinds of experiences we have reported in the Gospels and Acts.
Sure. So this was the motivation initially for this, to kind of as an answer to those who say all eyewitness claims are simply accretion or addition but you're saying no, we see this all the time now in history. Eyewitness claims of miracles are a continuous trend, as it were, from biblical times to today, and so there's no reason to see the eyewitness claims in the Gospels as different in that sense.
Yes.
Good. Well, I think I summed that up quite nicely. Let's meet our other guest, Jeff, who joins us. Jeff, thanks for coming in today, and great to meet you for the first time on the show.
Great to be here. I'm a fan of the show.
Well, I've quite often looked over your blog, which is always very interesting, Jeff's Shorts, and you quite often comment on the Facebook page of the show and that sort of thing, so
yes.
You'll be familiar to a number of people listening. Give me your background. You're an atheist, but you had a sort of religious upbringing, didn't you, to some extent?
Yeah, I think that's true of most people in Ireland. I was a little older than Keener's Nine when I self-identified as an atheist. I think that was maybe when I was 14 years old. Going more into my background, I was born to Catholic parents, baptized a Catholic, and went to two very good Catholic schools. Most important people in my childhood life were Christians. I think it was about the age of 14 that I started to give it serious thought, and the more I thought about it, the more I realized it was not something that I felt to be true. But still, I did have a number of important Christians in my life, so I felt, in a sense, obliged, but more I wanted to make an effort to believe.
Mm.
And I feel I tried that for some time. After a certain point, I began to realize that belief in the claims of Christianity wasn't something I saw on my horizon, but I still retained an interest in finding out more of Christianity.
Yes, and you do regularly engage with people on the forums, I think, in, you know, conversation as well with people. So it's something, obviously, you are still interested in. You haven't closed the door on, presumably, people coming up with evidence and interacting with that and that sort of thing.
I do like to think I'm open to that. It's hard to be a witness for oneself in that regard.
You have done the incredible job of reading the entire thing, these 1,200 pages of what Craig's written here, within about a week, which must have taken some doing.
I think I've given quite a number of people on light rail transport a completely the wrong idea of my faith position as I curled up with the miracles on the way to and from work. And I think my wife is a little fed up of seeing me on the couch with it, busily scribbling notes in a notepad.
Well, we'll get your responses to the book as we go through. Today we're talking, did the miracles of the New Testament really happen? Next week we'll focus more on, do miracles happen today? Though I think that will enter our conversation today as well, in a way. Let's come back to you, Craig. And I think it might be useful to start with just a working definition of a miracle. Craig, how do you define a miracle?
This is one of the most important fundamental questions, and it's also one of the most disagreed on. but I see a couple. In the book, I was dealing with a couple issues. The first one was, do eyewitnesses report experiences like those in the Gospels? But the second subsidiary issue was, can these reflect special divine action? There's no universally agreed on or, I think, perfect definition of a miracle, something that we'd all agree on. Hume's definition of violation of natural law actually doesn't fit a lot of the biblical accounts. I mean, even the story of the parting of the sea, it says in Exodus 14 that God sent a strong east wind and blew it back all night, which isn't obviously a customary or usual experience. But on the other hand, you can't say it doesn't have anything to do with natural... it's not really a violation.
It's not a violation. It's kind of a miracle that happens through natural means, yes.
And for theists, you know, God can be at work in nature as well as in some other way. And probably most miracles in the Bible could be looked at that way. Some of them are debated which way to look at. But I guess the definition that catches most of the miracle claims in the Bible would be divine action that gets people's attention, like a sign. Now, that's a fairly ambiguous definition, and even when you use it, even when you have an action like in John 11, it speaks of the raising of Lazarus after 4 days. Not everybody who was present was persuaded that that was a divine action. So there is some ambiguity around the issue of the definition and whether everybody would perceive the same thing in the same way.
Sure. I think tying into this, you mentioned Hume already. He has kind of often been put forward as the person who philosophically disproved the miraculous. You do talk about this in the book. Take us there, and then we'll get Jeff to respond. What do you make of Hume's debunking of the possibility of miracles?
Sure. This is a current debate in the philosophy of religion, as well as whether miracles are possible or not, kind of depends on whether one accepts theism or supernaturalism on the one hand, or on the other hand not. But Hume actually didn't originate most of his arguments. A lot of them came from particular deists, but Hume certainly popularized them. He condenses some of their arguments, and he viewed miracles as a violation of nature, which was quite different from how his contemporaries viewed them. Most of the early English scientists, Isaac Newton, Robert Boyle, and others, they believed in natural law, but they didn't believe that God was subject to natural law, so they didn't see a contradiction. And Hume also was viewing the laws of nature in a way that would be different than we normally would today. I guess there are different ways of viewing it today, but I think today probably we would be more likely to view laws of nature as descriptive rather than, you know, setting out a rule for saying, well, if this can't happen, since laws sometimes vary with conditions, like some scholars have pointed out with superconductivity or black holes, and theists could say, well, in the case of special divine action, things might work in a different way. But what seems to me to be Hume's central issue is that he is appealing to uniform human experience. I think both in his understanding of what the laws of nature are like, and also in saying, well, you know, we can't trust eyewitnesses who argue for miracles because uniform human experience is against it. And the majority of philosophers who've been writing on this essay of Hume's in the past few decades regard that as a circular argument. There are some who will defend it, but the majority regard it as circular. And I think it's a circular argument. I think that Hume himself, I mean, I shouldn't be speaking for Hume posthumously, but I think that Hume probably wouldn't have tried to make that particular argument himself today. We have a 2006 Pew Forum survey of Pentecostals and Charismatics in 10 countries. And in those 10 countries alone, and among Pentecostals and Charismatics alone, it comes out to somewhere around 200 million people who claim to have witnessed divine healing. And then the survey also included those who did not claim to be Pentecostal or Charismatic. It was around 39% of Christians claimed to have witnessed divine healing in those 10 countries. And then a report from within the China Christian Council about 10 years ago said that about half of all new conversions in China had been due to what they called faith healing experiences. And we have things like this elsewhere, in India and so on, that many of the conversions of people so convinced that this is something out of the normal that they've experienced have changed long-term religious affiliation as a result of that. Now, I'm not by any means implying that all of these claims actually would pass muster by anyone's definition of miracle, but to appeal to uniform human experience as a starting point against miracles, I think I don't think that would work.
Yeah, against the background of that many counterclaims. Very interesting. Right. I mean, I don't know, before we get into the meat of whether miracles in the New Testament really happened, Jeff, if you want to talk about this issue of Hume, do you differ from sort of Craig's analysis there?
I'm at a bit of a disadvantage in not having read too much Hume. My reading list has been rather full recently. I think the best way to discuss it with Hume would involve resurrecting him, and that would obviously
put an end to the argument altogether.
Yeah. I think when you talk about the numbers and surveys there, that brings up a point I wanted to raise, that I think that there was a need for this book. You've certainly demonstrated to me that a lot of Christians do believe in miracles. On Hume, I think maybe within the first 20 or 30 pages of your discussion on him, I felt the urge to call you up and say, I fully agree. Please, can I skip to the end of the section? I think you're very thorough in showing that the argument, as I understand it, is a circular one. It's not one that I held to before and not one I hold now.
Yeah, and so you don't a priori dismiss miracles just because you're an atheist in that sense, Jeff. I mean, well, Jeff.
Yeah, it's not that I
mean, is that sort of...
It's not that I disbelieve in miracles because I'm an atheist. It's that my understanding of and experiences of the world have led me to believe that there are no supernatural powers, and until I'm presented with evidence to the contrary, I assume there are no miracles. I think the best analogy I can give is going back a little before Hume to, I think, 1696. No one had ever seen a black swan. The first one was found in 1697. So someone in 1696 in the UK could have said, there are no black swans. Universal human experience says there are none. And they would have been wrong. Mm. They could have also said there are no blue swans. Mm. And they would have been right for the wrong reasons.
Mm. I see what you mean. Mm. I mean, let's come to miracles in the New Testament. Craig, I guess there's all kinds of questions that come up when people start to look at the kind of miracles that are attributed to Jesus. It's not just healing miracles, of course. There are all these nature miracles, water into wine, walking on water, feeding of the 5,000. Obviously, the key one, the biggie, is the resurrection. We've done that a number of times actually on the show, so I'm not too concerned about spending too much time on it today. But do these other miracles, which are scattered through the Gospels, and sometimes appear in a couple of Gospels, sometimes it's just in one. Do they have as much credibility in that sense as the resurrection? I mean, can we take them with as much certainty in a Christian sense as the walking on the water as we can the resurrection?
Well, the resurrection, you have more attestation for it because it was more important to the early Christians. So it's repeated a whole lot more. You have Paul, who was previously skeptical, was willing to join a persecuted sect because he was convinced that he'd met the risen Christ. He cites, in 1 Corinthians, he cites earlier tradition, cites over 500 at once who saw Jesus. And it's hard to explain this as simultaneous hallucinations for all these people. It's quite rare at best, and especially when you get it on multiple occasions. But and then there are other lines of evidence, even the approximate site of the tomb being inside the walls of Jerusalem, when that site actually was outside the walls of Jerusalem at the time of Jesus' death. But like around 41 to 44 was when Agrippa the First was the king, and he expanded the walls at that time. Somebody later on wouldn't have made up Jesus being crucified inside Jerusalem, knowing that people were normally crucified outside a city. So, I mean, there are various lines of evidence for arguing for the issue of the resurrection, whereas with other kinds of miracles in the Gospels, they're not as central, and so you don't have so much attestation for a particular incident. But if I can make some comments on just from a historical standpoint about what kind of evidence we do have for Jesus as a miracle worker in general. Now, these are not... this is separate from the question of whether these were supernatural. This is just the question of whether Jesus was experienced in this way by his contemporaries. Mm. But for that, every bit of evidence we have, and some of it going back to within the first generation, emphasizes Jesus as a miracle worker. I mean, in the Gospel of Mark, which is normally dated somewhere around a generation after Jesus' public ministry, I said earlier, like 31% of the verses in Mark deal with that. You have it also in the other strata of early Christian testimony. You also have it, now this comes much later, in the detractors, like Celsus and the rabbis, who acknowledged Jesus, and in the case of the rabbis, some of his followers, as miracle workers, although they explained it as sorcery. But then also you have Josephus, writing in the first century, who the majority of scholars agree that he wrote about Jesus. The majority also agree that the passage has interpolations. But when they've stripped out the interpolations, the additions to that passage in Josephus, they've also found an early Arabic copy of Josephus that has what they thought it would have without the additions. So that fits what they believe is the original version of what he said about Jesus. And it mentions him as a sage and also as a worker of paradoxa, which Geza Vermish, Jewish scholar at Oxford, and a number of other scholars have argued that means the same thing it means when Josephus talks about the paradoxa of Elisha, namely that Jesus was a miracle worker. So it's very early in our sources. It's pervasive in our sources, and it's unanimous in our sources that Jesus was experienced by his contemporaries as a miracle worker.
Hmm.
Now,
we're going to have to take a quick break, okay. and we'll come back to let you finish that thought, Jeff.
Sure.
Jeff, Craig. Getting my Jeffs and Craigs confused.
Either of us.
and we'll have Jeff respond. Interesting stuff. I mean, what we're hearing so far is that, from your point of view, Craig, there's no reason to doubt, in a sense, all the extra evidence we have of the period about Jesus suggests that everyone regarded him as a miracle worker, and this sort of helps us to helps the credibility of the New Testament accounts that these weren't just later editions, etc., of these miracle claims of Jesus. But we'll come to Jeff for his take on that in a moment too. You're listening to Unbelievable, first of two programs where we're looking at miracles. Today, miracles in the New Testament, did they really happen? Do miracles happen today, we'll be asking next week. My special guest today, Craig S. Keener of Asbury Theological Seminary, where he's a New Testament scholar. His latest book is Miracles, The Credibility of the New Testament Accounts. And Jeff Lillis is our atheist in studio today, who is in conversation. Welcome back to Unbelievable. This afternoon we're talking about miracles, asking, did the miracles of the New Testament really happen? Did Jesus feed 5,000 from just five loaves and two fishes? Or is it the other way around? Two loaves and five fishes. walking on the water, water into wine, the many healing claims. And how does that tie into modern miracle claims? Well, Craig S. Keener is a New Testament scholar. His latest book, Miracles, The Credibility of the New Testament Accounts, is a comprehensive work covering a massive number of modern-day miracles and looking at the justification, therefore, for eyewitness claims to miracles and how that ties into eyewitness claims of miracles in the Bible. Talking with Craig today is Jeff, who's an atheist, regular listener to the show. He's come over from Ireland today to be with me in the studio, so a trip just for us, which is very kind. But he's not convinced that we can draw conclusions of miraculous events from two millennia removed, and he has discussed modern day miracle claims on his blog, which I've linked to with the podcast of this program. If you want to respond to anything you hear on today's program, I should have said this earlier, but you can email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you want to get in touch on Facebook or Twitter, it's UnbelievableJB is the tag you're searching for, okay? Links to all that from the website, as usual, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We heard in that section, Craig, making the case that Jesus, according to all the sources we have, was seen as a miracle worker, Jeff. And from that perspective, it gives us some confidence that the miracle claims that were attributed to him were miracle claims, at least that people believed had happened at the time. Now, that doesn't prove that they did actually happen, but at least he was regarded in this way.
Sure, that's certainly the aspect I'd rather focus on than the resurrection. As you said, we've had a few shows on that so far. I think I'd bring Sathya Sai Baba into this. He died, I think, last year. The Economist estimates his followers at 100 million. He's based out of India. He managed to offend all three Abrahamic faiths by claiming to be the Messiah, a reincarnated Sufi saint, and the second coming of Jesus. His miracles include raising someone from the dead three times, telepathic repair of an engine. He's very obviously a fraud, but he did manage to convince 100 million people to follow him. Now, to say that they all believe his miracle claims is a bit of an exaggeration, but certainly some do. And I feel a little uncomfortable making such an analogy with Jesus. But I do believe it is possible for large numbers of people to believe miracle claims that are false.
that is the conclusion you would draw. Whatever people thought they saw, it wasn't actually happening.
My conclusion is that we have good examples of large numbers of people believing in miracles that definitely aren't true. Mm. That does not necessarily mean that all miracles aren't true. I've yet to see what I feel to be good evidence of a miracle. And I would have to remain agnostic on miracles in the past with a strong skeptic edge.
Craig, what's your response?
Well, Jeff makes a good point. In terms of when you're dealing with history, anything we know about in history is a matter of probability. I mean, that's just the limits of the historical method, the limits of extant historical data. And also, the particular example he gives I'm not familiar with, so I can't address whether I would have thought that anything supernatural was going on there, or whether it was faked, or what it was. But could these reports from the first century have been explained in other ways? The answer from purely historical perspective is yes, they could be explained in other ways. I mean, we have religious cures in a lot of cultures. Recent studies have shown the importance of psychoimmunology, how beliefs can impact immune responses. Obviously, they can cure psychosomatic ailments. There are psychogenic illnesses that perhaps the roots of it being psychological can be addressed in those ways. On the other hand, in the case of Jesus, it looks like it's something more than immune responses. Again, we're dealing with something 2,000 years ago, so we have to keep that in mind with our evidence. But with the evidence we do have, it's apparently on a wide scale that Jesus was known to do these. We have multiple reports, instant cures of things like blindness or raisings from the dead. You know, with even psychosomatic and psychogenic, some people have argued that in some cases of blindness it could be psychogenic. But I don't know a whole lot of reports of very many psychiatrists who cure people instantly from it, and certainly not in public. And embellishments. David Strauss argued for this in the 19th century. And his argument was actually more convincing, I think, than some of the earlier arguments who said, you know, walking on water, Jesus just knew where the rocks were or something. But Strauss said that they were myths that arose over time. But embellishments usually arise over a long period of time. And Strauss was dating the Gospels much later than I think our evidence allows for dating them. So, yes, you can offer other explanations, but I think you can also offer a supernatural explanation. And if we have reasons to believe in the God of Christianity, then I think that explanation is more compelling than a contrary explanation.
Yeah, just to come in briefly on embellishments there, one of my favorite stories, which I read recently in a book called Faith Healers by James Randi, which I believe you might have read yourself. It's mentioned in
yes.
your index. He gives the story of a boy who broke his arm, both the radius and the ulna, had a cast put on it. The next day, the boy went to his father and said, "Father, please take off this cast. I've prayed to Jesus and it has been healed." After a long discussion, the cast was removed, the arm put in a sling, and the arm was fine. It had no further problems. On further investigation, this is many years later, a doctor wrote to the investigator and said what actually happened was the boy was an obstreperous child who would not listen to his doctor's order. He'd had a small fracture of one bone, which wasn't complete. He had a splint a cast for 3 weeks. This was removed and put in a sling as the arm had mostly healed. And the author of the letter wrote at the end, "I should know because I was that child."
And the point being that miracle claims can, in the telling, be embellished. Craig, it would be interesting to know how you respond. I mean, what gives you confidence, though, that the Chinese whispers effect didn't take place where someone said, "I saw this happen," and then it became a larger thing and goes from Jesus stepping out into the shallow water, I don't know, of Lake Galilee, turns into him walking across a stormy lake? What kind of tools do we have to answer that kind of a criticism?
Well, I think Jeff is right that stories do get embellished. What I'm talking about is like a wholesale embellishment of the entire tradition out of nothing, as opposed to there actually having been miracle reports. But when you look at the kinds of sources that we have, the early kinds of sources that we have, The Gospels fit the genre of ancient biographies. It was the only kind of work that you had that was about a particular historical figure. And in the case of the Gospels, I mean, they're about a recent historical figure. So we don't have any novels that were about a recent historical figure. And in terms of the way the material would have been passed on, I did a study. It's actually not in my Historical Jesus of the Gospels. I published it a bit after that, but where I went back and compared some biographies from this period about a particular character, in this case Otho, who was of about a comparable date before the writing as the Gospels were after Jesus' public ministry. And so what I found was, even in Suetonius's biography of Otho, which is maybe one-fifth or one-sixth the length of Mark's Gospel, I found about 50 points of detailed correspondence with both Plutarch and Tacitus's accounts of the same person. So they weren't just engaging in free composition in this genre. They were depending on prior information. And in terms of the traditions being passed on, they would be most likely passed on in the context of a school. That's where oral tradition was most accurately passed on. That's where it was most emphasized being passed on, although there was heavy emphasis on oral memory throughout antiquity. At the time that the Gospel of Mark is being written, and it may not be our first Gospel, but it's the first one, most scholars would agree it's the first one that we have, at the time it's being written, it's not too long after a number of the chief disciples of Jesus, who were eyewitnesses, had been in leadership in the Jerusalem church. So a lot of this material would have been coming from their teaching and their testimony, and not just a more uncontrolled general recitation.
I'm going to accept a lot of that, and I just remember in your book, specifically around the walking on water claim, if I can summarize, I think it was, why would they bother writing about someone who wandered into the sea for a bit, which might not be quite the words you used, which I think is a good point. Now, in terms of the length of time between the events and them being written down, I don't have as strong an objection to that gap as some other atheists, but what I will say, though, is we do have more modern-day accounts of faith healers, both Christian and non-Christian, who we know to not have done the works they claim to have done, who have had that material appear in their biography. I'm thinking of, have you heard of the Angels of Mons? It was a World War One tale. Is that familiar to you?
I think it may have been cited by Muhlenberg in his book on angels, but I'm not... I don't remember everything.
The Angel of Mons. Tell us quickly that story.
Very briefly, World War One, English platoon in retreat. Angels arrived to defend them, and I think it was St. George at the charge. Turns out this wasn't a true event. Within 2 years, there were books, pamphlets, there were eyewitnesses coming forward. It didn't actually happened, though. The story had been written in a newspaper by an author of short stories who'd written in the style of a factual news report for more impact. He wrote letters denying the claim, but it was still very much accepted by the masses.
It sort of took on a life of its own as a true claim. I mean, I guess that the implication is, in recent history, we can see things that people claimed to be miracles becoming sort of part of popular biography, but which we can still see were not true. So does that apply in terms of the biography written down of the New Testament? Do we have any stronger claim for the veracity of that?
We do have the kind of examples Jeff mentions. I know today, in recent centuries, we have George Washington's vision. We have in antiquity, Lucian says that he generated a rumor, and then everybody else came forward saying, yeah, I saw that too. So obviously, those kinds of things do happen. What I wanted to show in the book by the principle of analogy was that we also have genuine eyewitnesses who have experiencing. Now, some of them we can't know if they're genuine. I mean, we're in the same situation in general as we are with, well, kind of the same situation as with ancient documents, except, you know, these are more contemporary to us. But sometimes, because they're more contemporary to us, we can also check with independent witnesses. And sometimes I found witnesses whom I know and whose credibility I know, which was a big issue with Hume in terms of the credibility of witnesses. And so, no, I wouldn't deny at all that there are fraudulent claims. But I think it would be quite a step to say that because some claims are fraudulent, that we would assume that, well, and I don't think Jeff is saying this, that all claims are fraudulent. I don't want to speak for Jeff, but sure. I'm guessing he would explain some of the claims in other ways besides fraud, right?
Oh, that's completely correct. And your earlier point about setting out to give examples of people having these experiences, I completely agree that you have done that and done that well and at quite some length.
I mean, as it happens, you don't see, I guess, in the modern day, or indeed in the Bible account, particularly reports of entire limbs suddenly growing back or appearing, having been amputated. What's your take on this? And I'll ask you both to be brief, as I've got a little bit of audio I want to play in as well at this point. But what's your take on that, Craig?
Well, it's true. You don't have it in the Bible either, so I didn't have to worry about the argument from analogy too much. I did come up with over 25 accounts of something like that. Some of them with body parts growing back, and they are of varying attestations. Some of them I wouldn't give any credence to. Some of them, they give me pause. But I also have some accounts from some people closer to me. Danny McCain is a really good friend of mine, and he talked about his brother's, how his brother's skin was burned all over, and his baby brother was crying continuously. They started praying, and suddenly he noticed his brother had stopped crying. He looked up, the skin had turned completely pink. Dr. Tanya Briggs told me about a deep wound that was over 4 inches wide, and he said that after prayer, it closed overnight. It wasn't instantaneous. There's also in a journal of religion and health, there's an article by someone who says that his brother, his eye was punctured. He said it deflated like a beach ball and was healed. That was over the span of a few weeks. And a lot of reports, I don't include these among the 25 because these aren't really exactly limbs growing back, but in terms of something visible, of lumps or goiters visiting, vanishing in plain sight. And a number of these actually are from people that I know fairly well, a coworker and other friends. In terms of the actual limbs growing back, if there are such reports, they are extremely rare.
Jeff?
Yeah, I think you made a good effort to address these. I'd also add in your descriptions of legs growing longer, of an infant growing back the tip of their finger, and you do some work on cataracts, which would fall into that category. Now, I try and divide the miracle claims into different categories just for my own organization. In some cases, for various reasons, often quite reasonable, say, for instance, China, you don't include many details, which I can follow up on, and unfortunately, those I can't offer much. In terms of the 21-month-old infant who regrew a fingertip, I looked into it. That's actually not uncommon in humans under 2 years old. We retain some of the fetus's ability to repair itself, specifically around fingertips and toe tips. On the leg lengthening, there's a, I suppose we call him a conjurer here, called Darren Brown. He's...
we might come to that in the next week's show, because I think that's something that kind of ties into modern miracle claims.
Yeah.
We'll come back to you in just a moment. At this point, I'd quite like to play in a bit of audio that I've had lined up. This rather touches on the issue. Again, it's not a story of a limb growing back, but this is the story of Craig Marsh, who is a pastor in New Zealand, and he has this incredible miracle testimony, which I heard a few years ago when he came in to tell one of our presenters about it. And I'll just play this out, but the backstory to this is that Craig had had, over a period of about 10 years, a number of operations because of stomach in the cancer, cancer in the stomach, and he'd essentially had the vast majority of his stomach and intestines removed. This got to the point where in 1999 he was really on his last legs, going to die pretty soon. He'd had many, gone to many places, had many prayers for healing. Nothing had happened to him. And without any expectation of going for healing particularly, he decided to do one last trip somewhere, to a sort of pastor's conference in America. This was a sort of, as he describes it, a dying man's last wish. He didn't expect to come back alive from the trip. He sort of said goodbye, really, to his family when he went. And this is the story of what happened when he got there. So so we'll hear this from Craig himself. This is the story of Craig Marsh.
So I arrived at this conference, ostensibly just to be a quiet participant, as it were, just a dying man's last wish, and it was at that conference that they took it upon themselves to pray for me. So when I, by the time I arrived there, I was an absolute mess, was bedridden for a couple of days upon arrival, until finally they actually carried me into this conference. And it was a Methodist ministers' conference. These were nice, sweet, conservative Methodists, bless them. And a small group of them gathered around me and began to pray for me. And something, Rick, sovereign, began to happen. And it started in the back row. And it just went row after row after row. People just began to inexplicably weep, wail, cry. It went on for 4.5 hours. God just took over this nice, well-structured, tidy Methodist conference. And for me, it was this, that I had taken a hold of an electric fence, you know, like, and I collapsed on the ground. I don't remember a lot more. And then as the sound settled and there was this hush, and everybody knew that something sovereign had just happened, that 4.5 hours had been taken over. Mm-hmm. And a sound could be heard, and those around me got very excited, and then some idiot went and got a microphone and put it against my stomach. Now, over the speakers in this auditorium, you could hear this, and my stomach was gurgling and chirgling, and well, I staggered to my feet, and they were all excited. I'm going, no, you don't understand. It can't do that. I don't have a stomach. It doesn't gurgle. But I was experiencing a phenomenon that you would take for granted. I mean, your tummy's empty, your body releases gastric acid, your tummy gurgles. I hadn't had that for 10 years, a sensation of being hungry. I hadn't had for nearly 10 years. And yet here I was starving, this overpowering sense of, oh, I could eat a horse, out of my way, I've got to eat. It was amazing. All pain had gone, all nausea had gone, all spasms had gone, all bleeding had stopped, colour had flushed back into my body. Instantaneously, I stood up a different man. I rushed off and sat down and had the biggest meal that you could ever imagine. I mean, I'd been living on a little bit of rice or banana every 3 days or so, simply because I knew I needed fuel.
Yes.
So such was the transformation. I underwent all manner of tests, x-rays, CT scans, you name it, because the problem was everything that had been surgically removed had been miraculously replaced. Mm. I began to put on weight. I could eat everything and anything. And it's been a really interesting journey, Rick. I mean, the Christian doctors will say, well, praise God, that's a miracle. But the majority of them are not. And for them, it's getting their heads around and having to accept about something they don't believe in. So often it'll be a case of, well, how to explain this? And their response would be, well, I don't know. Mm. So, but you've told me I have a stomach. Yes. But that's been removed. We know. You tell me I'm producing gastric acid, yes, but you removed the vagus nerve. I can't produce gastric acid. We know. Well, how can this be? Well, we can't explain that. And I got to be honest, I am sometimes not gentle. I mean, that's a miracle from God then, isn't it? God's done a miracle. And immediately the response, just about every time, is, oh, I'm not prepared to say that.
Yes.
We'll explain it. Well, I can't. Then it's a miracle. Well, I'm not prepared to say that. And we just keep going round and around and... for them, it's then they're faced with that scary reality that there is a God, that he does intervene, that he does do miracles, that he does heal.
There you go. Very interesting story. I've kind of chucked that at you without you having much chance to look into the background of that. But, Jeff, what's your initial reaction to that story?
Well, I feel I almost seem like a real darapuss in the corner here, pouring scorn on anyone who's being healed. If he's better, that's great, and he sounds quite happy, and I take joy that he is experiencing more from life. I think if you can get me some medical records, I might be coming back and sitting in the Christian chair. Do you know if he releases those?
I don't know. I'll try and get you some. You know, I got his email address. We can always, I'll put you in touch with him. I mean, it's on the face of it, it's an incredible sounding story. If his entire stomach had been removed, more or less, and was all replaced, brand new, in one go,
it sounds like a great case. I mean, if you can get prior medical records of such and such a surgery performed, removing X, Y, and Z. Then if you can get, you mentioned an ultrasound, I think. He mentioned
CT scan, x-rays. Yeah. Well, I don't think you'd come across this one when you were doing your research, had you, Craig?
No. I've got just samples. And I also should mention, I think chapters 7 through 12, which include a lot of the miracle claims, here I was saying, okay, well, we have hundreds of millions of claims. What are some samples of what some of these claims are? So in those chapters, I wasn't, I wasn't going through the criteria to say how sure can we be, because in a lot of cases we don't know. But I think with the case that you just played, I mean, as Jeff said, if you get the medical documentation for that, I think that sure sounds like a miracle. In my own case, I guess I would want to just follow it up. I believe in miracles, so I don't have a problem with that happening. But it is the medical documentation, or at least some independent witnesses that we know in some other way who would attest it, could really help us to be more certain of of the claim.
Well, we'll see what we can do in lieu of this program, see where that takes us. But very interesting. We're going to take another quick break, and then we'll have a quick summing up in just a short moment's time. And we're going to be continuing this conversation next week as well, as we look at more examples of purported modern day healings and miracles.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Maybe just to come back to you, Craig. We heard that story. There are so many, though, and even though you've got hundreds in your book of modern day miracle claims, it's still really only scratching the surface. You mentioned those figures earlier on of just how many people claim to have experienced a miracle or a healing of some kind. So just coming back to the core subject, though, of today's program, did the miracles of the New Testament really happen? Why have you spent so much time on modern day miracles in a book which the subtitle of which reads The Credibility of the New Testament Accounts? How does this all tie in as a total, as it were, evidences and credibility for the New Testament accounts of miracles?
It's really a response to Hume's argument, as developed more explicitly by Troeltsch and others, as an analogy argument that says we don't have credible eyewitnesses today that say that these events happen, so there's no reason to believe that these kinds of events have ever happened. And so recently some scholars have begun turning the analogy argument on its head, with the recognition of the kinds of reports we're getting from all over the world. And actually, those kinds of reports, not on the scale of today, but those kinds of reports, we have records of them going way, way back, including in Hume's day, and Hume actually knew about some of them. but just turning the analogy argument on its head, we can say, since there are claims like this today by eyewitnesses, some of them credible eyewitnesses, it's plausible to believe that there could have also been credible eyewitness claims in the first century as well. It's not really an argument for each individual miracle, but just to address the argument that has normally been made against the miracles.
So, Jeff, did you understand that was the kind of purpose of the book when you read it?
Ooh, I think that's certainly the purpose of one section of the book. There are other miracles which you feel are, which Dr. Keener, I believe you feel are better attested, and some which earn your backing. In terms of building a convincing case that it could have been reliable eyewitnesses who claimed experiences of miracles in New Testament times, I think you've done an excellent job of proving that. My concern around the book, well, there's two things I say around the book building on that. I've done my best to investigate the miracles as far as I can and some of the people around it, and at this time I still remain unconvinced of miraculous activity. Secondly, in some cases I am a little concerned that you might have emboldened some people who I feel to be less than honest in their dealings and perhaps taking advantage of the faith in others. And I certainly don't feel this was intentional, but some of the names and people on the list, having looked into them, do cause me some concerns.
Well, I think that'll give us a good point at which to return to the conversation next week as we address the other half, if you like, of this subject. Do miracles happen today? And we will, you know, take some time to look through in some detail at some of the various miracle accounts and the people involved with them in the book. So for the moment, thank you, gentlemen, both for joining
us
today on the programme, and I look forward to you both joining me again, same time next week. Hope you enjoyed that discussion. If you did, then part two's coming next week. You can find our archive of past shows, of course, at premierunbelievable.com, and register for our newsletter right now. We'll send you a free ebook, God's Not Dead by William Lane Craig, his evidence for a creator from science and philosophy. You can also book your place at Unbelievable The Conference 2022, God Unmuted, at unbelievable.live. The links are all with today's show. For now, thanks for being with us, and see you next time.